Okay, sorry about that. It's when my computer died, I lost the rec I didn't lose the recording, but it wouldn't let me continue. So, all right. So, we've done these intercarpal joints, right? When we have to remember that basically when we look at them, we've got anterior, posterior, interosseous ligaments. Of course, anterior would be considered part of palmar, and posterior would be considered part of dorsal. And then we have interosseous ligaments, which means we have tiny little ligaments that lie between the carpals themselves. So you can see them all here. So you've got the capitohamate ligament, the triquetralhamate ligament. You don't need to know these, but we just need to understand that for obvious reasons, because we have these carpal bones all kind of lined up against each other in these plane joints, we have all these tiny little ligaments, these interosseous ligaments that are kind of holding them all together in place as well, right? So again, palmar ligaments, dorsal ligaments, and interosseous ligaments. So what movements occur here? Well, as I said, the gliding movements of the carpals occur simultaneously with movements at the wrist, and it is these intercarpal relationships that result in the vast range of motion that we actually do get at the wrist when we're moving the wrist around. And I do ask questions on this. Flexion and adduction occurs at the wrist joint, which would be the radiocarpal joint, and extension and abduction occur at the midcarpal joint. Okay? So again, if your patient is lacking in either of those movements, it may indicate where which joint may be affected that's preventing them from doing some of those movements. So you can see that again, a lot of ligaments here. Now, the carpal metacarpal joints, which of course are the proximal row and the articulation with the base of the metacarpals, so they're plane. They have common joint cavity with intercarpal joints. The distal surfaces of the distal row of the carpals articulate with the carpal surfaces of the bases of the metacarpals at the carpal metacarpal joints. So we're saying that here, remember, here are the heads of the metacarpals, right? The knuckles. Here are the bases. We're saying that the distal row, the distal surfaces of the distal row articulate with the bases of the metacarpals, right? So the distal surfaces of the distal row of the carpals articulate with the carpal surfaces of the bases of the metacarpals at the carpal metacarpal joint. So if I just, where's the other one? Where? Yeah. A Halloween wind chime. If I just kind of pull here a bit, we can see that, again, remember the heads are here in the metacarpals, the bases are here. So the distal surface of the distal row articulates with the carpal surfaces of the bases of the metacarpals, right? Okay. So down here, right? They are united by dorsal, palmar, and interosseous ligaments. So we do have some ligamentous attachment there. Now, the first carpal metacarpal joint of the thumb, so that would be the carpal metacarpal joint, would pretty much be the scaphoid and the base of the first metacarpal, correct? Okay. It is a saddle joint. So if we look here at it, if you get to see it for the real thing, you can see how it is actually a saddle joint. You know, if it's in there, actually, you know, because you hear about saddle joints and you don't necessarily always see them. It's not a perfect saddle joint, but you get the idea, right? That fits. Okay, you can see it there? See, kind of fits. Okay. Do you remember what movements a saddle joint allows for? Do 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 do. See? Saddle, saddle. No, it's a saddle saddle. See? Right? She's ignoring me. See you, saddle saddle. Okay. You see it? What's that? Okay. So, the saddle joint, so it is the trapezium and the base. I said scaphoid, sorry, because the scaphoid is a proximal row. That was my mistake. The trapezium and the base of the first metacarpal, it has its own separate joint capsule. So remember, the carpal metacarpal joints of fingers 2 through 5 share a fibrous capsule, synovial membrane. The first, the saddle joint, has its own. So this allows for flexion extension, AB adduction, circumduction, and opposition. Of course, the important movement that allows for is opposition, which is considered the functional movement that allows us to use tools and all those sorts of things. So we can see here is our saddle joint. It's been removed here, taken away, and you can see how they're convex concave into convex concave, and it sits accordingly, which allows for the movements to occur here. So, do I have it on here yet? No, I'll get to it in a moment. All right, the metacarpal phalangeal joints, they're condyloid in nature. This, the head of the metacarpal articulates with the base of the proximal flange. So this represents the knuckle. So when you make a fist and you look at the knuckles, yes, you are looking at the heads of the metacarpals, but you're also looking at the articulation with the bases of the proximal phalanges. Right, and that's what's moving up and down, is the metacarpal is sort of sitting still, and it is the proximal flange that's sliding and gliding. So we've got a concave base of the flange on a convex head of the metacarpal. What's the slide in flexion? Same direction or opposite? Same, because it's concave. So that would be movement in the anatomical position anteriorly. Extension would be posterior glide, right? Because the bone that's doing the movement is concave, therefore the slide glide is in the same direction as the movement. Okay? So the head of the metacarpals at the base of the proximal flange, their overall articular surfaces. There are collateral ligaments here, okay, on either side. And there are also palmar ligaments, which create something called volar plates. These are thick plates of cartilaginous tissue. We're going to get into those a whole lot when we start looking at the muscles, okay? Second to fifth palmar ligaments are united by deep transverse metacarpal ligaments. So we can see that. I thought I had it here. Yeah, so here's your volar plates here. Okay, here we've got them going on. So the transverse ones are here, these volar plates. We can also see that this ligamentous material also creates sheaths that the ligaments of the distal, I should say, sorry, the proximal muscles that arise here as they travel into the hand, travel through and around these volar plates. We can see here's flexor digitorum superficialis. You can see one of its tendons is traveling down through that sheath where it gets to where it needs to get to. Fibrous capsule and synovial capsule for each MCP joint. These movements do flexion extension, AD, abduction. I got AD, AD there, typo, and circumduction. So this, and this, I'd like to see anybody do circumduction with the third or fourth finger. Yeah, if you hold the other ones. It's hard, isn't it? Can you do circumduction with the third by itself? Good for you guys. Okay. (Clears throat) Okay, and the fourth? Well, good for you. Okay. The next ones are the interphalangeal joints, of course, the joints between the phalanges. They're a hinge joint. They only allow for flexion and extension. We have to remember digits 2 to 5, the head of the phalanx with the base of the more distal one. Therefore, we have a proximal interphalangeal joint and a distal interphalangeal joint, pips and dips. Whereas in the thumb or the first digit, we only have one interphalangeal joint. 2 in fingers 2 through 5, 1 in finger 1, interphalangeal joint. Okay? So we can see here is the volar plate that we can see here, which is the thickening of the tissue here, of ligamentous tissue. And you can see how what it does, it acts as a bit of a pulley and protects the ligament, or sorry, the tendon of the muscle as it's passing through and heading out distally. So here's an interphalangeal joint. So this is the proximal phalanx. This is the distal, or in this case, the middle one. So it's either one, 2 through 5. We can see the flexion extension here. We can see the collateral ligaments here that are preventing any sort of ABA deduction kind of movement of the fingers. Again, straight hinge joint, so it flexes. Here's our volar plate here. We have a number of things here. We have ligaments that do surround and create sheaths for the tendons as they pass through. We'll be talking a whole lot more about those when we get to the muscles. You can see here is our interphalangeal joints here. So we've got one here with the collateral ligaments, another one here in the distal. And of course, this would be either 2 through 5, and then we have them here. And of course, these are your metatarsal phalangeal ligaments joints that we can see here. Here's your palmar ligament here that creates the volar plate that we can see there. Yes. Yeah, you could actually have a ligamentous tear or a sprain. So you can have one through three, depending on what's going on. One would be a minor pull, three could be a complete rupture of the ligament. And that can occur here. If you get like a jam finger and shove things together, you can actually do damage to those ligaments, yes. So ligaments. So we said the fibrous layer of each metacarpal phalangeal joint and interphalangeal joint capsule is strengthened by medial and collateral ligaments, right? Makes sense because they're only hinge, okay? Denser cord-like parts that pass distally from the heads of the metacarpals and phalanges to the base of phalanges. So denser cord-like parts, and they pass distally from the head of the metacarpal, which is the knuckle, right? Okay. And phalanges to the base of the phalanges. You also have the thinner fan-like parts that pass anteriorly that attach to thick, densely fibrous or fibrocartilaginous plates. And these are also known as the palmar ligaments or plates, which form the palmar aspect of the joint capsule. So we can see here that we have these ligaments that come around. So we'll go back again. So thinner fan-like parts, they pass anteriorly to attach to thick, densely fibrous or fibrocartilaginous plates. So we can see here that here's our cord-like part of the collateral ligament. And then we have these fan-like that travel anteriorly that form these volar plates. Okay? We can see them here as well. And you'll note what they are. They're thickenings, as I said, that allow the tendons to pass. So we can see, so this is on the palmar surface. We're looking at this digit. We can see a particular muscle here called one of the flexor tendons. There can be more than one. They pass through the groove here and then along this groove and along this groove. And these are the broad parts of the fan-like parts of the collateral ligament that form a thickening over top of the joint, which of course would help protect the ligament or the tendon as it passes over the palmar surface of the joint. Does that make sense to everybody? So we go back to this picture. You can see how, again, this is the palmar surface. Here is the cord-like part of the collateral ligament. Here is the fan-like part that's creating the volar plate here that the tendon passes over as it's heading distally out the flexor tendon. Yes? No, that's within the joint itself. Anybody here have a trigger finger? Yeah, where you have a finger, you'll close it and then it gets stuck and you have to kind of click it to get it out. Anybody here ever had that? You've had it a few times? Would you use your hands a lot in previous work that you may have done? Okay. So to give you an idea how this works, when you have a trigger finger, right, the tendons rely on these grooves to help transfer the vector of force appropriately into the fingers. When someone has a trigger finger, depending on which one it is, because the extensors have something somewhat similar, what's happened is the tendon has fallen out of the groove. So because it's out of the groove, the finger can't open, and the click that opens the finger is the tendon falling back into the groove. What's that? Yeah, you have it? Little finger or first finger? Your pinky gets stuck and then it pops, right? Yeah. So that's because the tendon's fallen out of the groove, and when it snaps out, the tendon's fallen back into the groove. And years ago, when I was meat cutting a lot, using my hands a lot, like, with knives and whatever, I got a trigger finger bad in my index finger, and I had to actually take anti-inflammatories to calm it down, and then everything kind of slipped back in properly. So, what's that? Yeah, it'd be the same thing, right? Using your hands all the time. Yes. So, when we think of these collateral ligaments with a dense cord in the fan-like, they are palmar ligaments, so they're involved in the flexor group. We have to remember, in the anatomical position, muscles that flex the fingers are on the palmar surface, and muscles that extend the fingers and the wrists are on the dorsal surface, right? So we say the palmar ligaments blend with the fibrous digital sheaths and provide a smooth longitudinal groove that allows the long flexor ligaments and tendons to glide and remain centrally placed as they cross the convexities of the joints. We're going to have to realize that we have muscles that flex the fingers that start way up here at the elbow. So the muscle belly goes down to about here, and then the tendon runs all the way through, all the way down through those volar plates to get out, in some cases, to the distal flange. So they have a long way to go. Yeah, on the palmar side. Yes, palmar flexes, dorsal extends. So imagine that you've got a muscle belly here, and then you have four tendons off that muscle, in the case of flexor digitorum, you have four tendons that pass and go all the way to the distal phalanx. So they travel, because they're going so far through the hand. No, I'm looking for my clicker. Oh, there They pass all the way down through the hand in these grooves. So I'll repeat, the palmar ligaments blend with the fibrous digital sheaths. So you have the sheaths that the tendons run through as well. So you have sheaths that are maintaining those tendons to run appropriately through the fingers. So they run through the sheaths, and then where they pass the joints, interphalangeal joints, they run along these grooves that are created by the volar ligaments, which are part of the collateral ligament. So the palmar ligaments blend with the fibrous digital sheaths, provide a smooth longitudinal groove that allows the long flexor ligaments and tendons, that should be tendons actually, sorry, to glide and remain centrally placed as they cross the convexities of the joints. Between 2 to 5 metacarpophalangeal joints is the deep metacarpal ligaments, and they lie deep to the palmar ligaments and hold the heads of the metacarpals together. So we actually have ligaments that hold the metacarpal heads together, tight together. Otherwise, they would separate. So we have these ligaments that hold these metacarpal heads really tight together in the hand. Okay? I know it seems complicated, but you got to think of how complicated hands move and work. So we need structures to support the movements that the fingers of the hand do in order to be strong, powerful, and have stability. So we have this flexor retinaculum as well, also known as the transverse carpal ligament. Basically, what it is, we call it a retinaculum, but it is actually a thickening of the deep fascia of the forearm. And it holds most of the flexor tendons on the anterior surface of the wrist. So here it is here. We can see how the carp. This is what I was talking about over here. You can see how the carpal bones, this is a very rudimentary diagram, but you get the sense, the way the carpal bones align, they create this concavity here. We talked about how the flexor retinaculum finds attachment on the scaphoid, pisiform, hook of the hamate, and so forth. It runs across over the top here. So you can see this represents the carpal tunnel, with the roof being the flexor retinaculum. And you can see how it lays here with all the skin removed. Here's all the tendons. So this is flexor digitorum superficialis here. We have flexor carpi radialis, flexor pollicis longus, and so forth. But carpi radialis doesn't really run through under the flexor retinaculum, so I shouldn't go there. But you can see how these tendons run under the flexor retinaculum. You can see it here as well with the dissection, and part of the flexor retinaculum has been removed so that you can see the tendons underlying here. Okay, so they actually travel through the tunnel. This is quite a nice picture that gives you a sense of it. So here's the median nerve. Here's flexor digitorum superficialis. Here's flexor digitorum profundus. And flexor pollicis longus. They all lie underneath that flexor retinaculum. So it's a thickening of deep fascia. It holds most of the flexor tendons on the anterior surface. It converts the anterior concavity of the carpal bones into a compartment for flexor tendons and the median nerve. Okay, its attachments on the ulnar side are the pisiform and the hook of the hamate on the ulnar side. On the radial side, it is the scaphoid and the trapezium. Okay? So think of it four, like it's square, with each corner finding attachment, both on the ulnar side and the radial side. Okay. Now, if someone does have carpal tunnel issues, they will surgically go in, literally, cut it, sit you back up. They just get rid of it. Because you can see how tight it can be here. And if you've got swelling or issues here, and that starts to, you know, really compress down on that median nerve, then you can have some problems here. So they literally release that flexor retinaculum so that there's no more pressure on the ulnar on the radial nerve. You're going to learn in assessments, if you think someone has carpal tunnel, you literally take their hand and you tap on it. And if that flexor retinaculum is tight, you'll cause recurrent paresthesia or tingling or pain into the thumb, first, second, or third fingers. Okay? We also have a palmar aponeurosis. Now, if you remember another aponeurosis that we had, in the back, one in the head, and one, right, thoracolumbar fascia or thoracolumbar aponeurosis, right? So, this palmar aponeurosis is a triangular part of the deep fascia and a muscle called palmaris longus. Palmaris longus does not pass under the flexor retinaculum. In fact, actually passes over top of the flexor retinaculum, okay? It's continuous proximally with the flexor retinaculum. It distally divides at the root of the digits and is attached to the base of each proximal flange. So we can see it here in the diagram that we've got our flexor retinaculum that is here. This is a bit of palmaris longus here, the tendon coming over top of the flexor retinaculum here. But we can see this broad expanse here. This kind of represents the palmar aponeurosis. What's interesting is, surgically, this area of the hand is considered no man's land. They don't like to surgically go into this area. There's too much going on, and they'll approach the hand from different areas on the palmar surface, so we don't want to go in here. So this is kind of, did anybody ever end up buying the Netter book for diagrams when I recommended it? Anybody buy Netter? They're awesome, aren't they? Dude sat in many dissections, and this is his drawings. You can actually find these originals around from time to time. They're worth a fortune. But he actually would sit in cadaver dissections and paint these things. Pretty neat, eh? And they're amazing, right? They really are amazing. And if you look at the books, the big books, they're beautiful, actually. They're almost worthy of framing and putting up on a wall. They're so beautifully done. So this is kind of the little lesser here, so you can see we have palmaris longus kind of in here, so things kind of get all together, shall we say, But this broad expanse in the palmar surface is your palmar aponeurosis, right? That many of the muscles do utilize. Okay, let's begin. Okay, I highly recommend that you chart this. And what's important to understand is, does the muscle cross the elbow? Does the muscle attach across the wrist only, across the wrist and the metacarpophalangeal joints? Does it go to the middle flange or does it go to the distal flange? So we have muscles that just cross the wrist, muscles that cross the wrist and the metacarpophalangeal joints to the proximal phalanx, and muscles that go just to the middle phalanx and muscles that go all the way to the distal phalanx. So we're able to do that with the tips, that with those, that with that, and that. So your muscles can do just that, muscles that do just that, muscles that do just that, and muscles that just curl the tips. So that's kind of how we break it down, okay? So that means then, come on up just for a sec, Nick. And this is, I'm just going to show you this just real quick. So for example, depending on the muscle I want to test, I may take his fingers out of the sequence, resist, just wrist flexion, wrist flexion. Okay, that would be one muscle. Then I would take and I would hold the fingers and resist extension. And then I would take and hold these fingers and I'm going to try to extend there and you're going to hold me, okay? And then the very tips of the fingers, and that's how you differentiate when you're muscle testing all these muscles in the forearm. And that was just the flexors. Okay, thanks. Okay, so that's your challenge, is to recognizing, does it cross the elbow or no? Does it cross just the wrist? Does it cross the wrist to the proximal phalanx? Does it cross the wrist and the metacarpophalangeal joints to the distal phalanx? So that's a good way to break it down. So the other part is we have a superficial group and we have a deep group. So that's the other way to look at them. So when we look at the muscles that are affect the wrist joint, they are divided into two superficial groups with three muscles each. The wrist flexor group is located anteriorly, as I've talked about, of course, and attached proximally to the medial epicondyle of the humerus by the common flexor tendon. All flexor muscles that cross the elbow are medial. All extensors at the wrist that cross the elbow are on the lateral epicondyle. So this is golfer's elbow, flexor group, whereas the extensor group is tennis elbow. Okay? So we're talking about muscles that are arising from the medial epicondyle and then affecting flexion at the hand and wrist. Okay? The wrist extensor group is located posteriorly, and two of the muscles attach proximally to the lateral epicondyle of the humerus via the common extensor tendon. So this is what we talk about when we say if someone has tennis elbow, it's tendonitis of the common extensor tendon. And then we start to isolate to see if there's a particular muscle that's the cause as well. And then golfer's elbows would be basically tendonitis of the common flexor tendon. Okay? The third attaches proximally to the lateral supracondylar ridge of the humerus. So we can see here is the, Here is the common extensor tendon, extensor carpi radialis longus, extensor carpi radialis brevis, extensor digitorum communis, extensor carpi ulnaris, and extensor digiti minimi. Okay? They all cross and they do it. Our flexor group over here, pronator teres is included in this group, which we've already done. Flexor carpi radialis, flexor digitorum superficialis, flexor carpi ulnaris, palmaris longus, and we have the common flexor tendon. Now, it sounds really complicated, like holy crap at this point, right? But look at the names. The names tell you so much. Let's just look here. Flexor digitorum superficialis. Okay? It's superficial. It does the digits. Flexor carpi ulnaris. Flexes carpus on the ulnar side. Right? We've got flexor carpi radialis, flexion carpus radial side. Okay? Extensor carpi radialis longus, extends carpus radial side. Extensor carpi ulnaris, same thing. Extensor digiti minimi, what would that do? Little finger. Use the names. They will help you. They kind of tell you just what they're called. It does make life a little bit easier if you just pay attention to the names, okay? So let's start with the flexor group. Flexor carpi radialis arises from the medial epicondyle of the humerus via the common flexor tendon, and it goes to the anterior side of the bases of the second and third metacarpals. Let's think about that for a minute. From the common flexor tendon at the medial epicondyle of the humerus, and it goes to the anterior side of the bases of the second and third metacarpals. Where are the bases? Nope, that's the heads. The bases are proximal. So remember, the bases are what articulate with the distal row of the carpals. Yeah. So here. So this arises from here, okay, to the anterior side bases of the first and second right there. Right, first and second. Remember, thumbs first. Okay? So let's have a look. God, I keep putting this damn thing down. I should just put it in my pocket. Okay, so here we go. So we're doing flexor carpi radialis. So we can see it here. Right? The medial epicondyle coming down across onto the bases of the first and second metacarpals. Okay? So what is this muscle going to affect? Just thinking about it first. Let's start proximally. Elbow flexion, good. Crosses the wrist. Right. That's about it. Okay, so this muscle crosses the wrist on the anterior side to attach onto the hand. Therefore, it flexes the hand at the wrist joint. Okay. This muscle also crosses the wrist on the radial side. And because it starts here and goes to there, it also radially deviates. Goes from here to here. So it's going to radially deviate. Make sense? Right? So it's in this direction. Therefore, it's going to radially deviate. Right? So because it crosses the wrist, it flexes the wrist and it radially deviates. Because it goes from medial to lateral. Okay? Some confusion? Good. It also crosses anterior to the elbow joint, so therefore it is an elbow flexor. The muscle crosses the radial ulnar joints anteriorly, that when it pulls on the lateral hand attachment, it does assist pronator teres in pronation, which makes sense, right? Because it's reaching over medial to lateral, so it's going to help pronator teres in pronation. So, elbow flexion, wrist flexion, radial deviation, and pronation. We begin. Okay? Now, in reverse action, a fixed hand results in forearm flexion. So, if you're trying to pull yourself up a something, it's doing that as well. Okay? Innervation, median nerve, C6, C7. The muscle test, I'll just let you guys are going through all these in lab, right? Okay. So we can see here then, flexor carpi radialis is right here, coming down to the base of the first and second that we see here. Stretch is the exact opposite, of course, would be elbow extension, wrist extension, and ulnar deviation, correct? Right? Doing the exact opposite of all of it. Elbow extension, wrist extension, try it. See how tight you all are. Yeah, pretty crazy, eh? That's from all the writing and stuff that you're doing. So elbow extension, wrist extension, ulnar deviation. Okay. No ulnar deviation. Yeah, make sure you're going into ulnar deviation. That way. No, but you're hypermobile. Okay? Right, so here you can see it, kind of looking at it from the front. Any kind of flexion, you can't, I really isolate this for strengthening because it shares the common flexor tendon. Just any kind of wrist flexion will work the muscle. Trigger points. It's located in the forearm and causes forearm and hand pain. There's no primary symptoms, but there are secondary symptoms, which include volar wrist and palmar pain. So you can get pain into this area here coming down, okay? Palmaris longus. So on the palmar side into the palm, and it is long. All right? This muscle is missing in 14% of the population. So if all of you just take your hands and try to resist making a cup with your palm, you should see that tendon right there. And somebody in here will not have one. You got them. You've got it. Go ahead. Yeah. I'm sure if you do. Yeah, you do. You don't. You do. Yeah, you got it. You got it. You got it. You don't. You don't either on the right side, but on the left you do. Yeah, you have it on one side, not the other, right? No, you got it. It's right there. Yeah, there. No, don't try to oppose. Just go like that. Just the palm. Yeah, got it. Yep. It's your other hand. Yep. You have one? You have them, Bob? Yeah, you got them. Okay. So there's a couple of in you here who don't have it. It's not unusual. Okay. Quite often, it's a muscle I don't teach. If you don't have a palmaris longus, you have a palmaris brevis. So there is a palmaris brevis. And so some people have both, but most cases, if you don't have a longus, you usually have a brevis. If you have a longus, you don't have a brevis. Just go like this. No, you don't have one. Yeah, you don't. You just have one. Yeah, there you go. See? Weird, eh? How evolution is, and for some strange reason. So, it arises from the medial epicondyle, the humerus, from the flexor tendon, and it goes to the palmar aponeurosis and the flexor retinaculum. Now, because it goes within the flexor retinaculum and the palmar aponeurosis, it does cross the wrist, so therefore it causes wrist flexion. When the wrist does not flex, the tendon pulls on the palmar aponeurosis, causing it to wrinkle. So I had you all do that to find it. This, it also does this. So it does this, and it does what you did to see whether or not you have one. Due to its proximal attachment, of course, you have forearm flexion. Now, due to its medial to lateral, it does help a little bit of pronation, but that's really minor. This muscle can only radially deviate the wrist when the wrist is in ulnar deviation. So because of it, if the wrist is in this point, it will help with this. But the thing to remember about this, this muscle crosses over the top of the flexor retinaculum. It does not cross under or within the carpal tunnel. It crosses over the top of the flexor retinaculum. Okay? Innervation, median nerve, C7, C8. So we can see here, we can see how it comes from medial bit to lateral into this palmar aponeurosis. We can see it here as well, and you can see how it's over top of the flexor retinaculum here as it comes into the palmar aponeurosis that we can see here. Okay? But you can tell that, you know, many of you don't have one in here. It doesn't really affect your function at all, right? It's kind of a rudimentary muscle to some degree. So you can see here, here it's present, there it is not. All right? So now you're going to all go home tonight and say to your loved ones or whatever, do this for me. Let's see if you've got something. All right? Stretch is a bit different. So when we look back at flexor carpi radialis, we went into elbow extension, wrist extension, and a bit of ulnar deviation. When we look at the stretch here, it's pretty much just straight down, we'll do palmar. Some of you might even find your tight here just in straight elbow extension, wrist extension. Okay. Trigger point here, basically needle-like sensation rather than deep aching pain. So it's needle-like and it can extend to the base of the thumb and the distal crease of the palm. Residue of this pain can travel to the distal molar forearm, but quite often this muscle, when you get in there, they're going to say the pain is right in the palm. And it's needle-like. It's not myofascially achy. Okay, so we did palmaris longus and flexor carpi radialis. Again, the name is, right? Went to the radial side at the carpal bones. Then we went to the palmar aponeurosis. Now we are at flexor carpi ulnaris. A flexor just past the carpus to the ulnar side rather than the radial side. So, medial epicondyle of the humerus via the common flexor tendon and the medial margin of the olecranon. So it spreads a little bit more than the other. And the proximal two-thirds of the ulna. So we can see here that it's, you know, we've got, it covers a fair amount here. So we got kind of covering a larger part here as compared. So here is flexor carpi radialis, you see crossing over to the radial side on the epicondyle, whereas this muscle finds itself on the olecranon and proximal two-thirds of the ulna, and it goes to the pisiform and the hook of the hamate. So where radialis went to the bases of the first and second metacarpals, this muscle goes to the pisiform and the hook of the hamate. Okay? All right? And base of the fifth. So pisiform, hook of the hamate, base of the fifth. So we have a distinct separation between the two, right? Flexor carpi radialis goes to the base of the first and second. Flexor carpi ulnaris, hook of hamate, pisiform, hook of hamate, and base of the fifth. So up here and all the way to the other side of the hand. This muscle crosses the wrist anteriorly. Of course, it flexes at the hand. Now, because it's on the ulnar side, it ulnar deviates. So flexor carpi radialis radially deviated because of medial to lateral. Flexor carpi ulnaris, because it's on the same side, ulnar deviates the hand at the wrist because it lies medial to that focus or that axis of ulnar radial deviation. Everybody gets that? Okay. Due to its proximal attachment, of course, it does flex the forearm at the elbow joint. Reverse action is the same as the other two. Now, this is ulnar nerve, C7, C8, so there's a bit of a change because it's on the other side. Okay. So the stretch is, again, similar. Like this, you can do it as well. And again, working forearm flexors will work the entire group of all of them. All right? Your PNF guide, I'm not going to use that now because some of you weren't here earlier. We just all found out yesterday that the Merle's guide that you guys have is no longer on the CMTO list. No, probably not now. But you've got Kisner and Colby, which is a remedial exercise book, so you can still continue to use that, and it should be just fine. Because Kisner Colby is still on there as far as that goes. Okay. No, but we had a conversation yesterday that we are going to take a pretty deep dive into. There are many books out there for joint mobilizations and PNF that we can have a look at and see as far as that goes. So. Okay. I think I won't get into the extensor group for now. So you want to try to see how bad your shoulder and wrists are? Okay, stand up. It's actually...